People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. And it's a great pleasure to introduce you to my guest tonight, who, as pianist, conductor, and recording artist, Howard Shelley, has enjoyed a distinguished career since his highly acclaimed London debut in 1971, performing with renowned orchestras around the world. He's been closely associated with the music of Rachmaninoff and has performed and recorded complete cycles of that composer's solo piano works, concertos, and songs. He's recorded, in fact, some 150 albums. All have been highly acclaimed, and he's appeared in several television documentaries, including Mother Goose, which was a documentary on Ravel, which won a gold medal at the New York Festival Awards. After extensive touring in Australia and in Tasmania, Howard Shelley has also made many albums for Hyperion's romantic piano series of Hummel, among others. Much of his current work is now in this combined role of conductor and soloist with major chamber orchestras. His long association with the London Mozart Players has now been recognized by the title of Conductor Laureate. Howard Shelley, a warm welcome to Fine Music Radio here on the tip of Africa.
Thank you, Rodney. Good to see you.
It was very interesting. We in Cape Town don't often get to see someone conducting from the piano, especially Mozart, two Mozart concertos, and then a symphony. So we had that kind of thrill of seeing you, who is so experienced in doing that. But I thought I'd start with that, and a naive question to begin. Is it easy?
Well, I've been doing it for so long now, it's difficult to judge. You have to be very clear, of course, and you have very little at your disposal once your hands are full to indicate to the orchestra. But you have to bear in mind that these orchestras are peopled by extremely professional, talented musicians who use their ears all the time. And in fact, not having a conductor between you and them and me facing into the orchestra and the lid off the piano means they hear very immediately the sound that they have to play with. And one of the nice things is that they hear you doing something spontaneous on the keyboard, say, and then they will pick it up in the next phrase. As far as ensemble is concerned, I've never found it a problem, to be honest, even when I do much larger repertoire. And I think the most important thing to me, why I ended up doing this as the main plank of my career and why I enjoy it so particularly, is that if you play a piano concerto, most piano concertos, you have to wait several minutes before you're in the piece.
Yes.
You sit there, you're getting cold.
Like Brahms 1.
Yeah, yes. You sit there getting cold and wondering whether the tempo is quite what you wanted it to be and whether the conductor, who you may have seen just for a quick rehearsal, is doing it quite in the way you would like it. And then you have to sort of start something that's already been started, if you know what I mean.
I do.
And I call it the once upon a time moment. You know, when you start a great movement, a great piece of music, the most important thing is to get the audience right from the first second, have their attention. A bit like when you start a program or when one starts reading a book to a child and you say, once upon a time. You don't say once upon a time or give it to somebody else to do. It's the way you say once upon a time, that's the most important thing. And it's the same in music. If you're telling a story with a movement, and you should be, it should have this long arc so that in the beginning you hear the end almost, then it's vitally important to have that first moment. And if I'm conducting as well as playing, I can start off the piece exactly as I want to tell the story. It also means I can get precise tempo I want, which is very important in Mozart, because if it's just a little bit off one way or the other, too fast, too slow, suddenly your fingers don't work in quite the same way and your brain gets in the way and you don't have this amazing flow and naturalness that Mozart's all about.
And number 20, which you played in Cape Town, has such a curious introduction, doesn't it? That
absolutely
dark D minor sound, long before the piano comes in, so you're able to set the mood,
exactly,
that rather restless, tragic mood.
Yes, it's extraordinarily dark for Mozart, and almost sort of jazzy when the upper strings go yum,
oh,
ba, 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 lum, ba, and getting that just
that
right.
Before.
And the interesting thing about that, although I'm talking about the music now, is that in that first phrase, which just sounds like a sort of almost a till ready, if you like,
yes,
you call
yes.
it in pop music, until somebody wants to come in with a tune, you get the dee-da-da-dee-dum, and then dee-da-dee-da-dum, which actually, several minutes later, turns into ta-dee, the piano takes over. So quite often, people who analyze this piece says, well, the piano comes in with something completely new. But Mozart, being Mozart, he's actually sown the seed in those early bars, mm-hmm. and we don't realize it, but the piano just grows out of those early seeds, even though there's a minute or two elapsed between.
And the 18 is quite different, as we discovered, isn't it? It's a much lighter piece, obviously. It's in a major key. The orchestration is lighter. The mood is so much lighter. So the ideal to pair, which I presume you think about when you're going to do a program.
Yes, and key-wise it also works. And this was an extraordinary period in Mozart's life when he wrote 12, I cannot think of another period in music, 3 years, when he wrote 12 concertos that we regard as the greatest, even now, over 200 years later. And the inspiration, the one I played in the first half of the concert, it was one of four concertos, consecutive concertos. He started with the same rhythm, yum, dum, da-dum, dum. This started yum dum da dum bum ba da dum. There's another one that's here, yum dum da dum bum 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 bum, and da yum da dum bum 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 bum. And there's another one, dum dum da dum dum dum. I only mention it because it just shows the extent of Mozart's imagination and ability to just use that as a key to start the work, just like putting the key in old cars, you know, and starting the engine, and then he was off, and each work he goes off in a completely different direction with a different feel to it.
And then you have the contrast, say, when you start Beethoven 4, which the piano starts so softly and such a short little piece, and then it's over to the orchestra.
Yes.
But at least you've started, that's what you're saying.
Yes.
At least,
yes.
Even though you're conducting from a keyboard, at least you've started. You've set the scene.
Though in that case, you start extremely softly.
Yes,
and it's
indeed.
A terrifying sort of balance in the hands. And most concertos up to that stage had been a large tutti for the orchestra, and then the piano came in with crashing chords and runs all over the place. I think partly because concert halls were very cold places in those days, with candlelight, and pianists just need to warm their hands for a while before they could, quite apart from the dramatic
But it's interesting, isn't it, with the Brahms, it's so long before the piano comes in.
Yes.
In the Brahms first, and yet in the second, the piano's in right at the beginning with the horn.
Yes. And Rachmaninoff, who's a performer himself, he kept on bringing the piano in as early as possible because he knew the problem. He didn't want to be sitting there getting
cold.
Cold and worried, you know, getting out of the mood of it somehow.
Well, we've come to your first piece of music now, and we're talking about Mozart, so I see you've chosen Mozart, but not a piano concerto, the Sinfonia Concertante for Violin and Viola. Tell me why this came up on top of your list.
I just find it such an extraordinarily expressive and heartbreaking piece of music, especially the slow movement when the violin and viola solos are lifting and drooping away in these heart-rending phrases. I could have chosen any of the piano concertos. They're all so glorious, over 20 of them. But this came from this amazing period in Mozart's life, just as he finished in Salzburg and finally got away from his father, for one, and the archbishop, who was living in a castle overlooking the city, and both telling him how he should write music. And he had got to the stage, having traveled in and out of Salzburg, that he realized Salzburg was a very small place, and he was desperate to write the music he wanted to write. And there's an odd work before he left Salzburg, like this Sinfonia Concertante, where you can see the mature Mozart. There's a piano concerto, the E-flat K271 already as well, which seems out of place because it's such a mature work. And you can see flashes of this extraordinary greatness that's yet to completely be fulfilled, but this sounds like such a mature work, Sinfonia Concertante.
Thank you.
Well, there we have to fade part of that rather beautiful second movement of the Sinfonia Concertante for Violin and Viola by Mozart with members of the Amadeus Quartet. The first choice of my guest, who is the pianist and conductor Howard Shelley, who is in Cape Town recently performing with the Cape Town Philharmonic two Mozart piano concertos and a Mozart symphony. And Howard, we were talking about the concertos and the logistics of conducting, but then when you get up and do a symphony, do you enjoy the purely orchestral conducting part as well?
Absolutely. Who wouldn't?
Well, exactly. I didn't expect you to say that.
No, I mean, it's I think most conductors regard it as a fantastic privilege. I mean, there is nothing, is there, that people get together to do in those numbers that requires such training. If you add up the hours that these people have spent, the orchestral players in their life, learning their instrument to this high degree, and I've got, you know, up to 1,800 people in front of me, all of whom are great musicians, and they are playing at a phenomenal degree of accuracy all the time. Notes, right notes are just a given, you know, even though the notes, they're floods of them, and they're very difficult for particular instruments. And they're listening all the time, adjusting by a split second, nanoseconds, to keep the whole orchestra absolutely as close together as is possible. So it's the most remarkable thing, to my mind, that people get together and do. And as a conductor, you have certain things you must do, like make it easy for them to be together and help them where corners are difficult. But also you must inspire them, and conducting is a funny mix. It's almost like black magic in a way. It's a very clear conductor orchestral players can admire, but they'll say, well, you know, but he doesn't give them up. And vice versa, they'll probably play their best and most together sometimes with conductors who are not terribly clear technically, but because they inspire them to make music in the way that rings a bell with them, mm-hmm. they will, you know, do everything to cover up the fact that he may not be quite so precise.
Furtwängler and Klemperer.
Well, yes, examples. Yes.
But I was interested when I looked at the list of conductors, and of course you've worked with many famous conductors, and very recently I happened to see by accident a clip of Sir Adrian Bolt, with whom you've obviously worked.
Yes.
With his very long baton, yes. And just moving it slightly. And they showed you a little clip of him conducting, and they took the sound away just for 30 seconds, and then they played you the same clip with the sound, and it was really quite extraordinary. And you wonder how, with that unbelievably limited movement, he managed to get that unbelievable
precision
that he did.
Yes.
Well, and also the power of the sound he sometimes got when he was conducting Brahms. I'm a huge Adrian Bolt fan, may I just say.
Yes, yes. Well, actually, one of the first concertos I ever played, Mozart concerto, was of Adrian Bolt. And I have to say it was scary in all sorts of ways, because, I mean, this was this very old man who was very, very distinguished. And we were doing a very well-known Mozart, the 488, the A major. And the slow movement of that, I couldn't believe how far the orchestra were behind his beat. And I, of course, if I had to be with the orchestra, I had to be equally behind his beat, and it was scary. It was like sort of hanging over the edge of a cliff, not actually with your feet on the ground, yes. And wondering when when you were just going to drop. He was magical, and I absolutely agree, an inspiring composer. And you know, a slow stick doesn't necessarily mean it's not being precise. It's what happens on the upbeat just beforehand.
Mm-hmm. So who would you say taught you to, or who inspired you in your conducting technique?
Well, there were a number of great conductors who I used to see as a young man, and I particularly like Rudolf Kemper, one of whose performances we're going to hear in a minute, because he was wonderfully upright, with a straight back. He looked as elegant as you could on the stage, and yet he had the orchestra absolutely in the palm of his hand, and without a huge amount of motion, not jumping around. I'm not saying that I'm like that, but I really admired his the total picture of him as a conductor and the depth of the music. He did wonderful Strauss recordings,
yes, but
all sorts of other
But
things.
With I mean, for example, when you did two Mozart piano concertos for us, then you did the Hafner Symphony. Mm. And I mean, by that stage, you would have got to know the orchestra relatively well. So you're standing up there and your movements and all that, you enjoy, and it's easy for you being away from the piano for that while, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
The thrill, as you said earlier, the thrill of being up with the orchestra. And also, when you spoke about musicians who are trained to the nth degree, somehow you've got to convince them to play it this way. Turn a phrase this way because that's what you believe worked better.
Yes,
or the bowings, for example.
Yeah, well, I have for the piano concertos and actually the symphony, I did my own parts because mm-hmm. for Mozart, there are so few markings that Mozart actually put in the scores that you, in order to save time in rehearsal, and a lot of orchestras don't have much time in rehearsal these days, and also energy and patience in rehearsals. It's good if the parts are already marked well for what you want, and it also helps you get what you want, because the thing about Mozart is he's one of actually the hardest composers to play.
I believe
the
so.
Notes are straightforward,
yes,
the harmony is straightforward, and it's almost the extraordinary simplicity of what he writes which makes it the hardest, because you have to play it within this classical box, if you like. You can't stray outside the restraints that they performed with in those times. But at the same time, you have to find a way of expressing, and every single note in Mozart has to have a little life, a little nucleus of life and love in the middle of it, no matter how fast it's going. And it's difficult to strike that balance, and all orchestras are different. Some will immediately play Mozart as you want it to be played. Others won't. They'll be unfocused, and you mm-hmm. think, well, where do I start here? Because mm-hmm. you're talking about such precision. And such tiny details.
And when you stand up in front of an orchestra that you haven't conducted before, like the experience you've just had in Cape Town, how long does it take you to know these are their strengths, I need to work on this a bit, they're responding nicely, I need to just concentrate there? Is it fairly immediate when you're up on the podium?
It's pretty quick, depending on whether you're already working with the whole orchestra, you know, mm-hmm. or whether you're doing a movement with a slightly reduced amount. But I was quick. And the amusing thing is that an orchestra will decide on the conductor
yes,
within
true.
Probably your first half minute or first minute. They'll know whether they're going to be happy. Whether
that must
most
be the worst thing for you.
Well, it just sort of focuses you to be
yes.
to start off as you intend to go on, because mm-hmm. it's like I was saying about an audience. If you don't grab them in that first few moments, you're likely to have a not such a happy time, you know.
Well, we've got miles away from Mozart now, a huge orchestral sound with Richard Strauss's Death and Transfiguration, Toton for Clearing, with Rudolf Kemper conducting. And, I mean, apart from the fact that this is a magnificent tone poem, why did you choose it?
Well, I've always loved it as a fantastic and great piece of music, which depicts so strongly the story it tells. It,
yes.
it starts with the heart beating and this man on his deathbed, and he revisits his life in different and then in the end, after the tension and of the fever, and the music and he are transfigured, and the when you get onto this plateau at the end, it is such a magical piece of imagination and music writing. But also my son, who's a conductor, went in when he was young for the Leeds conducting competition, and we went up to the last round to hear it, and he had chosen Strauss and this piece, and
gosh,
I thought,
it's quite adventurous.
God,
yes, for a competition,
this is going to be embarrassing. And I was hiding behind, because I knew the orchestra and I was sort of slinking behind pillars in Leeds uh-huh. town hall, trying not to let anybody see I was there. And the orchestra just played another work. It was the end of a long week, and I felt that they were tired in the first work. It was Mussorgsky, actually. Didn't go terribly well with one of the other people that got into the finals. And Alexander got up and started the Toten für Klärung, and the orchestra was absolutely transformed.
Good gracious.
I mean, it's a great piece of music.
Of course
so,
it is. Yeah.
So long as you give the orchestra the chance, they're going to be committed. But Hilary and his mother and I sat there and talk about transfiguration. We couldn't believe what we were hearing, because he had been studying in Germany. Mm. And although I had said to him at one stage, you know, if you want to conduct, now's the time to get into it. Don't do what I did, which I sort of made my name as a pianist, and then I sort of slinked into conducting, because people will always remember you as a pianist.
Of course. I mean, you think of Barenboim and Ashkenazi, for example, who you think first and foremost as pianists.
Yes, it's interesting. Even people will still say, well, of course, he's a pianist. But, I mean, they do so much and such wonderful conducting, and orchestras admire them musically, that of course, it doesn't hold. But if you want to be a conductor that an orchestra really takes serious, it's better to start as a conductor. And he took me up on that, and he studied conducting in Germany. He found a teacher who he really liked and gave him a very fine technique. And as I said, we were just blown away, and we had managers of other orchestras come up to us with tears in their eyes at the end and say, gosh, you must be so proud. And
what a lovely story.
And it does sound rather proud when I speak about it, but I it's not something I feel responsible for in any way. Mm-hmm. It's just we were lucky to have a boy. I suppose the musical genes from both of us just happened to fit together. And he just happens to have the things that make up a good conductor, which is much more these days than just being a good musician
and
being able to wave your hands.
Absolutely.
You also have to be willing to do PR, and you have the face of the orchestra, and orchestras survive or don't on the strength quite often of their conductor. So it's a very strenuous position.
Well, after all that, we're not going to hear Howard's son, Alexander Shelley, conduct, but we're going to hear a favorite conductor of yours, Rudolf Kemper. And I'll tell you what, why don't we pick up Toten Verklärung at the moment of Transfiguration, that glorious theme comes in, and take it to the end. Shall we do that?
That would be lovely.
Well, that music is almost from another world. The last 3 or 4 minutes of the tone poem Tod und Verklärung by Richard Strauss, Death and Transfiguration. In fact, the Transfiguration music we heard there with the Staatskapelle Dresden conducted by Rudolf Kemper. The second choice of my guest, a celebrity guest on People of Note this week here on Fine Music Radio, the pianist and conductor Howard Shelley, who was in Cape Town earlier this month, treating us to performances of Mozart conducted from the piano and also of a symphony. And we were talking, Howard, just before that about your son, Alexander. And he, I think, was in Nuremberg, wasn't he, for a while? Now he's gone to America. So is he now fully pursuing a conductor's career?
Yes, he's a very, very busy guy all over the world. But he's still at Nuremberg for the next year, and he's just taken on the National Arts Center Orchestra in Ottawa, actually, in Canada, and doing masses of stuff all over the world as well, going to Australia, New Zealand regularly.
The big thing to ask you is, have you ever worked with him? I mean, you told that lovely story just before the Strauss about how you hid behind a pillow when you were doing that competition.
Yes.
But have you ever done a major piano concerto with him?
Well, I have now, but we left it a very long time. Places he's been have said to him, you know, in press interviews and things, are you going to play with your father? And I must say, I always sort of said, no, I don't think it's right to begin with. And for the first, well, it must have been getting on for 10 years. We didn't do anything together. But then in Nuremberg, they said, well, would I come and do Rachmaninoff's third piano concerto with Alexander conducting? And of course, in my dreams, it's a lovely thing to do, to play with your son who grew up hearing you learning and practicing these things for hours on end, going to sleep under the piano, more or less, in the room below. Because, of course, he knows exactly what I do with these pieces. So to have him conducting it, quite apart from just the family connection, is absolutely wonderful. So we did. We also did it in England once, the Rack 3, and we did it several times in Germany on that occasion. And I'm actually, my next concert, or one of my next concerts, is going to be with him back in Nuremberg, doing the first concerto and the Rachmaninoff Paganini variations. And then next year, actually, in Australia, to Tasmania, where I've been going every year for the last 35 years on my own, he will be there too. And we will do all four concertos and two concerts and three.
You know what I have to ask you, and it's a curious question. I hope you don't mind me asking this, but I was intrigued to see, you know, we know you so well from the Hyperion series of all those romantic piano concertos, the Hummel. You are the pianist on the midday concert signature tune on Fine Music Radio, the Hummel, and all that. And so the Rachmaninoff comes as a surprise, because I think of you more as a Mozart, Hummel, classical pianist, but I know you're not, that you are a Rachmaninoff expert as well. But why Tasmania? Because when I saw, because you've recorded for Hyperion, I think, in Tasmania.
Yes.
What is the attraction of Tasmania?
Well, first of all, actually, I haven't played the Rachmaninoff concertos regularly since I was young, because I went more into direct from the keyboard, and you can't, although I've been asked. You really, it's not right, direct the Rachmaninoff from the keyboard. No, because you have to look after very romantic, surging lines in the orchestra.
And some tricky rhythms as well that the orchestra
is trying to play the flood of notes yourself. You know, you don't have a lot left over for that. And although I think it has been done, it's not something that appeals to me. So there's a limit to, I have actually recorded the Grieg, the Schumann and things, and I love directing those from the keyboard, even Saint-Saëns 2 and the Gershwin Piano Concerto. But it's a slightly different thing. So they've been earlier works that I've tended to direct from the orchestra, early romantic piano concertos, which do still work well. So what was the second part of your question?
I was just wondering why Tasmania? What was the attraction to Tasmania?
Well,
and with even Hyperion coming all the way out there to record you with the orchestra there.
Well, I started in Australia touring regularly every year quite early. I went with the Finnish orchestra, who suddenly lost their soloist at the last minute, and they needed somebody who could play Rachmaninoff, Grieg, and Tchaikovsky at the drop of a hat, and do it on the day they arrived. So I did that at the Perth Festival, and then I got started going regularly. And I love the Tasmanian orchestra from the very first moment I went to them. It's a medium-sized orchestra. Tasmania itself is the most wonderful place for me, and the world in a way. It's just beautiful. Not so different from this area, actually, Cape Town.
Oh, really?
Mount Wellington is a bit like the Table Mountain here. And the orchestra is just so fresh. They're a radio orchestra, so they're very high quality. Everything's broadcast that they do. And after working with them for some years, I thought, well, I wonder if I can persuade a record company to take recordings off them. Initially, the ABC did the recordings and sent them to London. And I actually started with Shandos there, but then it changed to Hyperion, and they're delighted with the way the orchestra plays. And and I get enough time, because we're always, these pieces are new to everybody, me and the orchestra. So you go straight into the studio, more or less, rehearse, record, but you need time to rehearse and then record.
And you need to know each other if you're going.
You need
to
know each other well, yes. And we have a fantastic relationship. It's just like family they are to me. In fact, I've seen their families grow. I know their children. Some of them are musicians now. It's amazing over the years.
Do you still go out there regularly?
Yes, every year. And next year, as I say, I'll be doing a recording week with them. But then, instead of my new normal concert week, I'll do it with Alexander conducting. He'll conduct the rest of the program, and I'll do Rachmaninoff concertos in each performance.
Good gracious me. Talking about Rachmaninoff, your next piece of music, which is due now, is Rachmaninoff's first piano concerto.
Yes. It's difficult to choose music for a program like this, because I'm usually playing it. I'm usually in love with the piece that I'm involved with at the moment. I am involved with Rach 1, and it's in a way, it's one of the less known Rachmaninoff works, the first and the fourth. Mm. And I'm very fond of them, a bit like one's fond of, people. The sort of black duck syndrome. No, what am I talking about? I've lost the ugly duckling.
Yes, the ugly duckling.
Not that it's at all ugly, but it's the one that doesn't get so many performances. And I think it's just a fabulous piece, which Rachmaninoff wrote when he was very young. All these works are young. Incidentally, Richard Strauss, when he wrote that extraordinary piece, was only 23 or 24. Mm. And this is a wonder to me, that these guys, Mozart, Strauss, Rachmaninoff, could write such amazingly passionate music when they were so young. He did revise it, Rachmaninoff, but I think it's just a glorious piece. And it would be this, or that would be the Second Symphony, the slow movement of the Second Symphony, or the Symphonic Dances. There are so many works of Rachmaninoff. I mean, when I was a student at college, I thought there were only a handful of pieces he wrote for, so the Preludes and the Etude Tableau. But I made 8 recordings of his solo piano music alone.
Yes.
And Rachmaninoff speaks to me. And he wasn't very popular when I was young, except for the odd work, but classical musicians tended to look down on him a little bit then. But Ashkenazi and Previn did all the concertos and the symphonies, yes. And people began to realize what a staggering composer he was.
Now, are we going to hear your recording of this?
You're very welcome to listen to my recording. Yes,
and
why not?
And which movement do we listen to?
I think the opening.
The opening, okay.
Yeah.
We'll have to take it out, the cruel clock Fine Music Radio. No, let's start from the beginning.
Yes.
Because it's a lovely opening apart from anything else.
It is, very dramatic.
And as you say, it never gets an airing too often.
No.
So here we go. Here is Howard Shelley in part of the first movement of the Piano Concerto No. 1 by Rachmaninoff. Well, as I said, part of the first movement of the Piano Concerto No. 1 by Rachmaninoff. And the soloist was Howard Shelley with the Royal Scottish Orchestra conducted by Bryden Thompson. And Howard Shelley is my guest. Howard, we know you so well from your many, many CDs in our library here at Fine Music Radio. But one of the things I've been asking you, we've been talking about the Romantic period, about Mozart. What is your take on this period instrument business, which has really taken the music world by storm, with the Roger Norringtons, John Elliott Gardners, dropping the pitch, you know, down to, what, A440 or whatever, and the Boeings and no vibrato. What is your take on that?
Well, I'm old enough to remember how things were before these people came along, and it's actually quite horrifying to look back sometimes at the performances of Mozart's slow movements, for instance, that were regarded as what you must do with Mozart. When I was young as a student, you didn't actually question these things too much. And they're so long and protracted and drawn out. And I think this whole movement has refreshed all these works hugely. And although I can't say I practice it at its highest level myself, of course I've taken in everything that people have had to say. But one thing, of course, is absolutely clear when you read Leopold Mozart and things and look back at those times, nothing was standard. There were no real rules that were held universally to.
I'm glad you said that. I think that's important.
I think it is, and I'm not always sure when I've read Leopold Mozart, his treatise on string playing, I'm not always sure that he means what some people then take as a general rule. For instance, certain uses of vibrato. I think Leopold Mozart was sometimes railing against really vulgar rubato by bad players a lot of the time. Whether he meant it to be quite as without rubato as some people would have us believe, I'm not convinced. And I don't know whether that's partly because also I grew up with, you know, the Amadeus playing Mozart and things. And there's something about getting to the soul of the music which is quite a lot more difficult if one is religiously original practice orientated. And of course, we do also know that both Mozart and particularly Beethoven were very frustrated by the pianos of their time. I mean, just before he died, Beethoven wrote that the piano was still a very unsatisfactory instrument. Of course, in his hands, the strings used to break and everything. And,
that's right.
And he was desperate for them to make it a stronger instrument. He compared it to a harp in his letters when he was younger. Yes, he said, you know, I hope it will become an instrument that stands on it with strength on its own right.
And imagine if he heard a Steinway Model D today, what he would do with it.
And, you know, Hummel, we were talking about my recordings of Hummel and things. He wrote down speed indications. He lived with Mozart for several years as an eight-year-old, learning with him. And he wrote down tempo markings for that period. Those are very fascinating, him and Kramer and others, because the tempos are a lot faster than the tempos I was brought up with. Mm. And the marvelous thing is now orchestras all over the world can play all sorts of styles for Mozart. So you can either ask them to play without vibrato or with, depending on how. And it means we have different types of performers to listen
to. Would you ever consider using a forte piano in an early Mozart concerto?
I have done it, and I recorded a Schubert record, which was very interesting. I did, because there was a period when I thought, well, I really want to know the instrument that these composers wrote for, because of course it gives you insight into even though I think they would embrace the modern instrument and love what it does for their music, it's still very useful to hear the quality of sound, particularly in terms of resonances and or relative dryness, and the interesting pedals they had on those pianos. Some of them have seven or eight pedals that would only partially, for instance, dampen the sound. It would dampen the overring sound beyond the bridge.
I didn't know that. So
I wonder, when Beethoven has these long passages where he wants you to hold the pedal down, whether he wasn't talking about that pedal, because it gives this very unusual aura around the sound, but it doesn't actually stop it from being fairly clear in the harmonic movement, whereas the modern instrument only has the one sustaining pedal, which just does blur the harmony too much. We can't.
Howard, a silly question just struck me when you spoke about Beethoven. Do you do much solo piano recording?
Recording? I don't do recitals. I haven't probably for 30 or 40 years now. I just decided that wasn't what I really wanted to do.
You want to do a concerto repertoire?
Yes, absolutely, and work with orchestras as much as I could, and I've been lucky to be able to do that. But I've recorded all the Clementi piano sonatas. That's 14 records.
Oh, gosh. But apparently,
I did those with Lamar Krausen, who was a he ended his life here in Cape Town.
In Cape Town, that's right.
A man I absolutely loved.
That's right.
I did a couple of Clementi. I had no idea that there were so many sonatas after that.
But you've made a few visits to Cape Town, haven't you? This is not by no means
yes,
your first visit.
But there's been quite a long period between the.
Isn't there a lovely story that I have to cue you to say that there's a picture of your son Alexander and yourself on
Table Mountain. Alexander's only, I don't know, 6 or 7, and there's a Dassie, isn't it? Standing up about half his height, and he's feeding him on Table Mountain.
Gosh, what lovely memories.
We have very happy memories of Cape Town.
I hope you've enjoyed coming back and that you enjoyed the concerts, you enjoyed
absolutely
the reception, and that you are going to come again one day.
Thanks so much, Rodney.
Howard Shelley, it's been great talking to you, and as I say, do come back. We've got lots of your recordings here, so our listeners know you well. And isn't it wonderful how we've discovered the joys of Hummel? I'm so glad we're hearing so much Hummel these days. But anyway, Howard Shelley has been my guest, and we're going to end with music by Ravel. Howard, you've chosen a short excerpt from Daphnis and Chloe to end, is that right?
Yes, simply because I love the orchestra. I can't imagine a world without orchestras and glorious music written for them. And Ravel was one of the greatest orchestrators ever. And when you listen to this passage from the second suite, you think, how can a human being just imagine this music?
Howard Shelley, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
Hi, I'm Alan Committee, and this festive season I'm back at the Theatre on the Bay with a brand new hysterical stand-up comedy show called Laughing Matters. In a world where political events move faster than our Springbok backline, where our sports teams can't outscore the Rand exchange rate, and crime means you get everything at a steal, I would suggest that Laughing Matters. So get your belly full of bubbly barrel loads of comic burble. Buy your tickets now. Alan Committee brings you all the Laughing Matters. Theatre on the Bay from December 6 to January 14.